is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio and online at kpfa.org. My name is C.S. Song. When it comes to the rejection of religion and of God's existence, Richard Dawkins, the British evolutionary biologist, sure gets a lot of play. In publications like The God Delusion, Dawkins fulminates against religious faith, calling it one of the world's great evils. That kind of message can get people fired up, but it can also alienate those who seek investigations into the merits of atheism that treat religion and the comforts it provides to believers with a measure of considered respect. There's also, of course, the matter of the great diversity in temperaments and perspectives among atheists. Some of that diversity is captured in the new book, Philosophers Without Gods: Meditations on Atheism and the Secular Life. In that volume, a philosophy professor named Joseph Levine recounts his own path to atheism, a path that included a strict Jewish upbringing, an exposure to the 60s counterculture, a stay in Israel, a reading of Nietzsche, and the challenge of creating family rituals and traditions in the absence of religious faith. Joseph Levine teaches at the University of Massachusetts Amherst. I asked him to explain what he meant when he writes that his parents, and he himself, were raised in Torah Jewish homes.
I use the term, and I don't know how standard it is for everybody. Most people would have said Orthodox. So when you normally think of Orthodox Judaism, that's what I'm meant by Torah Judaism. The only reason I didn't want to use the word Orthodox is that nowadays that covers a wider variety of positions or lifestyles than I wanted to get at. So what I think is essential when I say a Torah Jew, what I think of as essential to that is one, that one really believes in the principal doctrines that there is a God who created the world in 6 days and has a special role for the Jewish people. One is a fairly strict observer of the Sabbath and a fairly strict observer of the dietary laws. Those are kind of the essential elements of what I think of as a Torah Jew.
And you believe the word fundamentalist is properly applied to Torah Jews. Might be obvious to some listeners, but how so?
Well, so for instance, when I was growing up, what I was taught in the yeshivas, which are the Jewish parochial schools, was that God indeed created the world in 6 days, that the world has been in existence for only 5,700 and some number of years, and that the entire five books of Moses, the Pentateuch, was dictated by God to Moses word for word, things of that sort. Now, the only thing to be careful about is fundamentalism doesn't mean that you necessarily take what was said in the five books of Moses or even in the prophets literally, because you have to see how the Talmud interpreted it. But if you take the Torah as a package deal with what was called the written law covers the Pentateuch, the prophets, and the writings, things like the Book of Esther and Song of Songs and those things that are part of the standard Hebrew Bible. If you take that together with the Talmud, that package you're supposed to believe is, you know, literally true. But the Talmud, of course, gives you interpretations. You are not supposed to, on your own, interpret the Hebrew Bible itself.
And the Pentateuch is the first five books of the Old Testament, Genesis, Exodus, Leviticus, Numbers, and Deuteronomy, correct?
Right.
Okay. What kinds of practices do Torah Jews, and therefore you when you were young, follow?
Well, so here are the main elements. The Sabbath, of course, is very important. Basically, from sundown Friday until about an hour after sundown on Saturday, you keep the Sabbath. And what that means is you don't do anything having to do with lighting or fire, and fire is interpreted to mean electricity, too, so there's no turning off lights. You can't drive a car. You can't write anything down. You can't cook. You can't even carry anything in your pockets outside of the bounds of your property. So there's that. There's keeping the Sabbath, going to synagogue both in the Friday night and Saturday morning. Another important aspect of it are, as I said, the dietary laws. So you can only eat meat that's been slaughtered according to the ritual slaughtering dictates. You can't eat milk and meat together, so you have to have two separate sets of dishes in your house for meat and for dairy. If you're a man, now there are different requirements for men and women. Men have many heavier requirements. You pray three times a day. And then one of the most interesting requirements that I talk about in the article is, again, only a requirement on men, not on women, is to study the Torah, which in practice mostly means studying Talmud. And that's actually a large part of a Torah Jew's life. Now, when you're young, you do that a lot. When you grow up, and unless you continue on in rabbinical school and make that your living, of course you have to work, so you can't do it as much. But many serious Torah Jews who have, you know, careers and the like do try to find some time during the day or week where they can spend some time doing what they call learning, which means studying Talmud or something of the sort.
You mentioned yeshivas. Do Torah Jews send their children to public school?
Not usually. It's avoided if at all possible. And again, it depends on the degree. And, you know, even among what I'm calling Torah Jews, of course, there are various degrees of integration with the outside culture. So many people listening to my description are going to have kind of form an image of a Hasidic Jew in New York with a big black hat and black coat and speaking Yiddish all the time and the like. And that is, of course, one form. But there are many others who are much more assimilated in broader American culture. And, you know, sometimes if someone is living in a place where there just isn't a yeshiva nearby, then they might send their kid to public school. But it's really avoided, and it's considered you ought to be living in a place where there's the right kind of cultural support for one's Torah Judaism. So it's rare that somebody that I would, you know, think of in the Torah Jewish culture would send their kids to public school.
You write that while there are many restrictions on conduct, and you've enumerated a number of them so far, there are many compensating advantages to living as a Torah Jew. What are some of those advantages in your mind?
There's something nice about the Sabbath. There's something nice about being removed from the outside world, from the world of work, from the world of the radio and television, internet, which was not an issue when I was young, but just removing yourself from all of that stimulation and having time to both reflect, rest, focus yourself on your relations with your family and friends, take long walks. I mean, it was very funny growing up in Los Angeles, where nobody walks anywhere, right? Everyone drives, you know, to go two blocks. The only time I ever really walked a lot was on Saturday, because I had to. And we used to do that. You know, it was a very standard thing. In the afternoon, after you had a big meal, took a nice long walk and then a nap. I mean, it was a very refreshing experience. Of course, I also experienced it as a restrictive, because of course, as a kid, I wanted to watch TV and play baseball and do those things. But yeah, I think the compensation there is significant, and it matters that you're mandated to do it. Because the funny thing is, you could say, well, can't you just get that advantage by just insisting you yourself do that? But somehow, if you don't have a culture that mandates it, you don't end up doing it.
That's the voice of Joseph Levine. He's professor of philosophy at the University of Massachusetts Amherst. And his article, From Yeshiva Bochar to Secular Humanist, is part of a new volume entitled Philosophers Without Gods, Meditations on Atheism and the Secular Life, edited by Louise Antony and published by Oxford University Press. You were sent to yeshiva, and then you left the school in 1966 to attend public school for the last 2 years of high school. What was that like?
Well, it was a big decision, and it was both scary and exciting. I had, as you say, been in yeshiva since I was 3 years old. And I had been studying Talmud since I can't remember exactly when I started, but something like 7. But in my last couple of years, right before then, so that would have been something like 8th and 9th grade, we're talking about the middle of the 60s in California. And I'm living, in fact, in an area of Los Angeles in the northern part of the San Fernando Valley where there was not a large concentration of Torah Jews. And, in fact, the yeshiva that my parents sent me to was a good hour drive from my house. So I started picking up influences of what was going on around me, and I got very curious, and I started to agitate with my parents to say, I want to see what public school is like. I want to try out this other culture. And I never have figured out why my parents said okay to that. But they did. So I went, and of course, at first I was somewhat intimidated. I was also, I should say, younger than most kids in my grade. And now I was going into a school where there were girls and boys in the same classes. That hadn't happened to me before. So in some respects, it was extremely intimidating. And the interesting part of it was, I think partly because, you know, I was kind of smart. I was an A student, and I was a little weird. I immediately gravitated toward the emerging hippie culture in the school. As I say, it's the 66 in Los Angeles, and it was still a minority part of the school, but it seemed the most welcoming.
Welcoming to smart kids?
Yeah. It wasn't a bad thing to be an A student, even though not everyone was into it. And I don't know, they were just more welcoming and tolerant, and they themselves felt like a minority that was looked down on by, as it were, the jocks and the like. So I kind of found them, and I have to say my first semester I had an English teacher who I am still very friendly with to this day, by the way, and she became a kind of den mother for the hippies in the school. So I kind of got in her orbit. And a lot of these students who were good at English and some of them who were into drama were the kids I started hanging out with. And that's where I sort of got introduced to the 60s culture. And I found it I took to it like a fish to water. To me, it was the most wonderful thing I had ever encountered.
And was that partly because you felt a kind of liberation from some of the rituals and restrictions you had experienced?
It was partly that, but it was also that it was an alternative. I mean, as I say, a number of these other kids were very smart. They were also into books. They weren't always into school and doing well, but they were into books. They were into talking about things. And I began to see an alternative way to intellectual fulfillment that was not as restrictive as the Torah way was. And that was very exciting, and especially a number of the teachers who themselves were very progressive and very influenced by burgeoning 60s culture. I just started to get models for how you could get fulfillment both in a communal way, and I mean, as you know, friendship and closeness, and also intellectually and ethically. And it presented a real alternative, and I hadn't really known that was out there before.
When you graduated from high school, did you go straight to college?
No. What happened was, again, I was only 16 when I graduated, so I felt like I ought to take off a little bit of time. And then, I have to say, I had never really broke with the Torah tradition, and I decided that I would try to give it another chance. And so I actually threw myself rather wholeheartedly into studying in yeshiva again, there was a rabbi who I had studied with when I was very young, who had a yeshiva that not only catered to kids in K through 12, but also was a place that people who were post high school could actually spend the entire day there. And I went to study in his yeshiva, and then I kind of threw myself totally into it and ended up studying in his school for about a year and a half, and then he sent me off to Jerusalem, where I studied for another year and a half. And so I spent about three and a half years totally reimmersing myself in that life, until at one point, rather dramatically, I decided that this was not for me, and that was the real break that happened.
This is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio and online at kpfa.org. My name is C.S. Song, and Joseph Levine joins me by phone from his office at the University of Massachusetts Amherst, where he teaches philosophy. He's author of Purple Haze, The Puzzle of Consciousness. And we are discussing an article he wrote for a new volume entitled Philosophers Without Gods, Meditations on Atheism and the Secular Life. We have links to Joe and his work and to the book Philosophers Without Gods on our website, againstthegrain.org. Okay, Joe, so you tantalized us before that reintroduction. What happened such that you broke, I imagine, emotionally and spiritually with the Torah Druze tradition?
I can theorize about it now. And we're talking, I was 19, so it's close to 40 years ago. But basically what happened was there was a lot of self-deceiving of myself when I threw myself back into it. I never could really shake the feeling, this isn't for me. I couldn't really believe it all, even though I kept telling myself I did. And then, actually, I started having some psychological symptoms while I was in Israel that, you know, were never really officially diagnosed, but I would say it was something like panic attacks. I would all of a sudden start having what looked like hallucinations and anxiety. I guess anxiety attacks is a better term. And these just started coming a little more frequently. And I remember actually going to see some Orthodox Jewish psychotherapists that were recommended to me by the people at the yeshiva I was at there. And I just realized it wasn't helping. And I just came to realization one day, you know what? I don't believe this, and I actually don't want this anymore.
So you decided to leave the yeshiva in Jerusalem. You attended UCLA. And I guess maybe this is a good point to get into your discussion in this article of three key ideas of Torah Jewish life: transcendence, community, and Aristotelian flourishing. Let's take them in turn. What do you mean by transcendence?
What I had in mind is the idea that the easiest example is, suppose a traditional Judeo-Christian God exists. So this is an entity who has a will, has a purpose, is all-encompassing, is the most fundamental, most important entity there is at the foundation of everything that goes on in the entire universe. Well, the idea is that here we are, you know, if you think of us physically, we occupy this very small portion of this very small planet and this small galaxy, right, in this vast universe. And the idea that what we do is connected to this entity that I just described, God, is a way of saying that we are part of what is most significant about the universe. It transcends our own existence in a certain way. And, you know, it's hard not to find that a very powerful idea in one's life. And it certainly makes it easy to see how to connect connecting to that gives you an automatic source of meaning for your life, an automatic source of direction, and an automatic sense of your significance.
The second idea is community. What do you mean by community in the context of this discussion of Torah Judaism?
Well, a very important aspect of Torah Judaism that I don't know if it's the same in other religions or not, is the idea of the Jewish people as a significant entity in its own right. I mean, there's God, and then there's what you're supposed to do, but then there's this entity, the Jewish people. And your connection with them, your being a part of them, is of paramount significance. And you're supposed to live your life in a way where you're not just thinking about your relation to God, but you're thinking about your relation to the people. Other Jews matter in a way that no one else can matter to you. It's like the feeling you have with that people might have for their own individual nuclear family, and that there's a special role for the people in God's plan for history. And as I described in the article, when I was religious, I believed this. I bought into this idea. On the other hand, it was, in many ways, the least compelling to me at an emotional level. I never could quite feel like, yes, I care about what happens to other Jews more than I care about what happens to anybody else. I mean, I could get the idea that I could care about what happens to my brother and my mother and my father more, say, than other people. That made sense to me. But this idea that somehow by virtue of being Jewish, someone living, you know, on the other side of the world had a closer connection to me than my non-Jewish neighbor down the street, always it was something that I didn't have a visceral feeling for. It's sort of an intellectual idea that it was an obligation to feel that way. But and I think it's kind of what made it easier for me to break with Torah Judaism than it is for other people.
And we're going to get more into what community means and the idea of the chosen people and your approach toward that idea in just a little bit. The third key idea of Torah Jewish life that you identify is Aristotelian flourishing. What is that?
What I have in mind here is, and this is a familiar idea in philosophy that does connect with Aristotle, but not only Aristotle. And so this is a oversimplified, unscholarly take on Aristotle, but basically the idea is, Aristotle's idea was that each kind of creature has certain capabilities that are distinctive to that creature. And what's best, what counts as the best thing, the most, the way that that kind of creature can flourish, is when it develops those capacities that are distinctive of its kind. So, you know, swimming for a fish might be the kind of thing. You know, running for a cheetah or something like that. So what is it for human beings? Well, it's our rational faculty. That's what is, of course, distinctive of human beings over all other animals. And it, by rational, I don't mean just intellectual, artistic, craft, you know, the kind of thing that humans can do that other animals don't do, the kind of creative efforts that involve our mental capacities. And to flourish in this way is to devote oneself to activities that develop these distinctive capacities to their, you know, highest level possible.
And what activities might that mean for a Torah Jew? What activities would lead to Aristotelian flourishing?
Well, in particular, what I had in mind from my life in yeshiva was the study of Torah. So in that case, I had in mind specifically a very somewhat academic intellectual model. And so it was the developing of the intellectual capacities that Talmud study in particular really brings out, because you really fine-tune your ability to distinguish among subtle differences in concepts, to follow arguments. And I really enjoyed the fact that it was considered a kind of religious devotion to do this.
This is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio, online at kpfa.org. I'm CS, and I'm speaking with Joseph Levine, professor of philosophy at the University of Massachusetts Amherst. We are talking about a new article he wrote for a new volume entitled Philosophers Without Gods, Meditations on Atheism and the Secular Life. We'll take a short music break and talk more with Joe Levine. Please stay tuned. And this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. Joseph Levine teaches philosophy at the University of Massachusetts Amherst. And his article, From Yeshiva Bahar to Secular Humanist, is part of a new volume entitled Philosophers Without Gods. It's edited by Louise Anthony and published by Oxford University Press. We have a link to Joe's book, Purple Haze, The Puzzle of Consciousness, to his faculty page at UMass Amherst, and to the book Philosophers Without Gods on our website, againstthegrain.org. My name is C.S. Song. Now, you were talking about a Torah study, and you emphasize in this article the incredibly important role that Torah study plays in Torah Judaism, this idea that you should be studying Torah except when working or you're eating. In other words, you have to have a good excuse. You ought to have a good excuse for not studying the Torah. Now, when you study the Talmud, what are you supposed to do when you come across a difficult or contradictory passage?
What you do is you look up all the commentaries who might have spoken about it, and you try to figure out some interpretation which makes the most sense of everything. As I mentioned in the article, there is a constraint here, and this is one of the things that most distinguishes this kind of intellectual study, I think, from philosophy or any other kind of academic discipline that one might do, and that is there's a kind of authority structure. So in the end, what the sages say, and the sages can be anyone from the prophets to the people in the Talmud to later commentators from the Middle Ages or the like, whatever they say, you are not to argue with. The only way that you can, you know, have a right to, as it were, in any sense, question what they say is if you find someone else at an equal level who disagrees with them. Your job as a student of this stuff is to make as many of what the sages say come out right as possible. Now, there are some arguments, you know. I mean, you read a passage of Talmud, they'll often say, you know, so-and-so said this, and the majority went against him on that, and, you know, so you can't paper over the fact that there are people who disagree. And there are later sages who have decided what the actual point of law is, if it's a matter that actually bears on practice. But your job is to make as much of it come out making sense as possible.
Now, one of the objections you developed to Torah Judaism was this looking up to authority, was this relying on Torah authority for the correct interpretation, the God's word. What did you come to understand? What convictions did you come to have about the appropriateness of that kind of approach?
There's two things. First is once I came to doubt as I would say as a philosopher, the background metaphysics, the idea that there really was a God of that sort who really did do all this stuff and really did dictate this. Once I began to think, no, that's not true. That couldn't be true. Then, of course, a lot of the authority structure just falls apart. And what I began to notice is that what I most appreciated about the intricacy and complexity and subtlety of the kinds of arguments, structures, and conceptual distinctions and the like that was being made in the course of this study really was, in a way, not all that different than, say, I've seen progress in philosophy over the ages, where it's later and later ages and periods where people are building on what was said earlier and refining more and more. And so, in many respects, some of the most interesting stuff is often to be found in the contemporary discussions, not because people in contemporary times are in any inherently smarter than anyone else. It's just that they've had the good fortune to have, you know, 1,000, 2,000 years of discussion behind them, and so they're not starting from scratch. So just as, for instance, today, no biologist or physicist is going to say, well, let me take seriously the possibility that Aristotle was right about the way the world's put together. That's a non-starter. You know, he was, of course, one of the greatest minds in history, but nevertheless, if you want to actually know the way the world's put together, you don't look at Aristotle. So similarly, I began to realize that, you know, we were taught to read all the most refined moves, as it were, that were made in Talmud study back into to Moses himself. And, of course, once the mythology, as I would put it, is dispensed with, it becomes obvious, no, actually the most interesting stuff is actually what was done much, much later. And in fact, the development of rabbinic thought is not all that different in form than the development of any other kind of intellectual movement.
There's also the issue of Torah Judaism's emphasis on the Jews being God's chosen people, that they are God's agents in the world. You write that Torah Jews carry out this mission as God's agents via Torah study. What objections did you develop, do you have, toward the idea that the Jews are God's chosen people?
Well, I just, in the end, found that ethically intolerable. And it always bothered me. Even when I was a believer, it seemed to me that there is just a certain kind of chauvinism involved. First of all, attributing to God the idea that he would pick one people and treat them differently, provide for them opportunities for both spiritual development and reward that were different from everybody else, just seemed, frankly, unfair. I didn't know how a just God could do that. And then I also began to see just in my own community. I mean, so one thing is just on the level of doctrine. Does this seem like an ethical doctrine? It did not seem like an ethical doctrine to me. This became more and more apparent as I began to doubt more and more. And it certainly fed those doubts. But then, you know, I might have said, well, there are lots of beliefs that people have that on their own may not seem right, but who cares? But I began to see some real effects of this, and I began to notice a real sense of genuine chauvinism, I guess is the best word, where what mattered to people was what happened to Jews, and it just didn't matter as much what happened to other people.
I'm imagining you're referring here in part to your experiences living in Israel, observing how Arabs and specifically Palestinians were treated by the Israeli Jews. What kind of impressions did this have on you?
Well, it's funny. As you know, when I went to Israel, I had, as I talked about earlier, I had those couple of years in high school where I was very immersed in this 60s culture. And a large part of that was the political culture of the 60s. And I, you know, had become an ardent opponent of the Vietnam War. I mean, young as I was, I wasn't able to act on it that much, but I certainly identified with the protesters. And then I got put into this environment where all of a sudden things were different. But somehow I still thought, you know, Israel was a separate case. Somehow the Jews, had a right to be in Israel and to create that state. And when I went there, I only at a sort of subconscious level started to feel more and more uneasy as I lived there and started to see the ways in which both Israeli Palestinians who were, you know, had Israeli citizenship, but then also the Palestinians of the occupied territories were treated in this second, third, fourth class, whatever you want to call it, way. And it didn't rise to consciousness right away. And especially when I first got there, there was a tremendous amount of military tension happening. I got there in January of 70. And at the time, this is 3 years, 2.5 years after the Six-Day War. And what was going on was what was called at the time the War of Attrition. And there were daily shellings and airplane raids back and forth between Egypt and Israel. And so because there was this sense of, you know, the state's in danger, I don't now believe it was really in danger, but certainly that sense was cultivated. I kind of suppressed feelings at the time of worrying about how the Arabs were treated. But it kept bothering me. And by the time I left, and especially after I was in college for a couple of years and started to read Chomsky, I started to reflect back on my own experience, and I realized, oh, I see. Yeah, this is really, really bad. And in fact, this is oppression of a piece with all the other kinds of oppression that I'd been opposed to. And when I would try to talk about this with people within the Jewish community, I just realized, no, this was a no-no. You can't go there. And the main reason was that it was just this, it's us against them, and we are special. We have the right to do things because we are God's people. Not everybody would use that terminology, but I felt it infected the climate. So even non-religious Jews who might not use explicitly the justification that we are God's people, somehow they are acting out of that kind of motivation. And it really repelled me.
Joseph Levine is my guest. He teaches philosophy at the University of Massachusetts Amherst. And again, we are speaking about an article he wrote that's part of a new volume entitled Philosophers Without Gods, Meditations on Atheism and the Secular Life. You can check out the link we've provided on againstthegrain.org to that book. And my name is C.S. Song. Now, another person you read in college was Nietzsche, the fiery philosopher. You write that you took from your early reading of Nietzsche that belief in God might be not just be wrong, but might be morally wrong. That belief in God might be morally wrong. How so?
Well, and again, for any Nietzsche scholars out there, I hesitate to say I am far from a Nietzsche scholar. But so when I went back to UCLA and I majored in philosophy, and for a while, even though I had kind of shed most of my practices, you know, I stopped keeping kosher, stopped keeping the Sabbath and the like. But I sort of held on the fence about whether I really believed in God for a while. And I remember taking this class on existentialism, and we read some Nietzsche. And then I had a lot of conversations with a graduate student who was a TA for one of my classes, and I used to just hang out with him a lot and discuss this. And the idea came to me that there isn't a conservative strategy. That is, you might think, well, what's the harm of thinking there's a God? You know, can't hurt, and it could be bad to be an atheist if there really is a God. So why not take the safe route and believe in him, if you can choose to believe, that is. And then all of a sudden I started to realize, well, no, Nietzsche had a challenge. Nietzsche said there's something about this kind of belief structure that's associated with Judeo-Christian belief in God that is really anti-humanistic, and therefore it's really wrong. It really inverts. It takes everything that is, you know, that Aristotelian flourishing I talked about, it is distinctively human, that it's human contribution, and it downplays that and instead projects it onto this non-existent entity and, as it were, gives it all the credit. And that there's something wrong with doing that. It's a kind of crime against ourselves. And that a morally superior attitude would be to both take credit and blame for ourselves and not project that onto non-existent unseen forces that are, you know, out there in the universe like God and the devil.
So much more ground to cover. You call agnosticism, and really a lot of people who begin to have doubts about God and God's existence start calling themselves agnostics. They say, well, you know, I don't know. I don't know whether God exists or not, so I'm not an atheist, but I'm an agnostic. And yet you call agnosticism the great cop-out. Why is that?
Here's an analogy that I like. When people say, well, you know, I don't know that there's no God, I can't prove it. My question is, well, are you agnostic about leprechauns? And, of course, if I ask anyone, do you believe there are leprechauns? They'd say, no. In fact, you'd say, I believe there aren't any leprechauns. So then I want to know, okay, so what's the difference? I mean, if you're going to appeal to a standard of proof where to count as an atheist, you have to be able to show that beyond any possible doubt that could be entertained, you know there is no God, then I want to say, well, okay, but I feel that that's true for leprechauns, too. That's true for the Loch Ness Monster. But if you're talking about normal standards of evidence that most people have for when they're willing to say they believe something doesn't exist, then it strikes me that they are in perfectly and exactly the same situation with respect to God as they are to all of these other mythical creatures, that there really isn't a difference. And the only reason that people are willing to take this or want to take this agnostic cop-out, as I call it, in that case, other than the other ones, is because of what is culturally taken seriously, not because of any rational basis that they have.
You acknowledge in this essay that one does lose something significant when one loses belief in God. Can you talk about that and also tell us what kinds of opportunities arise for us humans when we leave God behind?
Yes, well, the two things that seems to me you lose that I mentioned in the article is, one, you start realizing that death is final. You know, I mean, when I was religious, I believed that I would continue to exist after my death in another plane or of existence or something. But basically, my identity would continue to live on. And now I see that there's no reason to believe that at all. In fact, not wanting to go into this now, there are probably good reasons to think the very idea is even incoherent. But even if not incoherent, no reason to believe it's going to be true. So that's one thing you lose. And I have to say that matters. It was a big deal to come to terms with that. And the second thing is, and has to do with something that I noticed that, for instance, in my leftist political, progressive political activity, which often involves working with people of faith, that they have something that I don't, which is they have faith that the right will prevail.
Mm.
Because there is this higher power that they have faith will make sure that happens in the end. Yeah, I don't have that. It really could happen that in the end we really screw ourselves over and that's it. We wipe ourselves out. That could happen. In fact, maybe that's likely. I don't want to take odds. But there's no room for faith as an attitude, it seems to me, once you give up God or anything like God. So what's left? Well, what's left, I think, is a kind of sober, rational, hopeful attitude. I think we can have hope. I don't think we can have faith. This is a huge topic that it would be good to go into in more depth about the difference between those two. But what's at least exhilarating, I think, is this thing that is the flip side of what I was talking about Nietzsche earlier, is that once one abandons the belief in God and realizes that it's all on us, the good things that happen and the bad things, it's all on us, then I feel that it gives us, rather than losing any meaning in our lives, it gives us the sense that we create the meaning in our lives, and it gives us a purpose because there's no one else to rely on. It really is up to us to make something of this world. The world itself is impersonal. The meaning is to be found from what we make of it. And I think that that's a heady and sometimes dizzying kind of thought. But in the end, I think it's an uplifting one.
Some people might call that one of the heaviest existential burdens there could be. Do you think that some people resort to faith to try and avoid that burden, to try and avoid taking up that burden?
Oh, I'm sure. I think one of the things that, and I really do want to urge people at this point to read the other articles in this volume, because what I found so interesting reading through the articles here, and at least two-thirds of them are by people who, like myself, had grown up with some fairly strong faith, is the different ways, I mean, very, very different experiences, and in many ways, very different interpretations of what their experience was like, but yet these common themes. And indeed, some people do express a real difficulty with having to deal with this angst that you mentioned about this burden, as you put it. And yeah, I think it is a burden. I mean, it comes up in all kinds of ways. It comes up in just trying to figure out how do you have a tradition? You know, how do you have a family tradition? How do you keep things going? How do you have a community? You know, how do you create these things from scratch? And the answer is, well, you don't, but you transform them, the ones you have, and you mix them, and you add your own bit, and you realize that you're part of an ongoing tradition, and you're not going to figure it all out, and you hope your kids get a little farther along that path. But to my mind, in the end, however big a burden it is, you can't base an attitude of how you're going to live your life on a falsehood. And so you have to come to terms with reality. Reality is we're here alone with the rest of the creatures on this planet. We're going to die. But, you know, we can make something happen. And that's, to me, the best you can do.
That's Joe Levine. He teaches philosophy at the University of Massachusetts Amherst. How important is it in your mind to replace Jewish rituals and traditions and holidays, all of which, as you've said, forge a sense of connection and community, with alternative rituals that can bind the communities that you are now a part of?
I don't want to speak for everybody on this. There's a lot of experimentation going on in the world. My daughter just told me the other day that, I guess, I don't know if this is quite right, but she read that 1 in 10 people in the world is on Facebook. I don't know if that's quite true, but but, I mean, there are a lot of experiments about lots of ways of having community, and I think we've just got to see where that goes. But I think what's been interesting in my own case is partly because I've been largely excommunicated from my own family because I chose to marry a non-Jew. And my wife and I, she's a philosopher as well, and we have 2 children, we've had as our family our closest friends who share our values, and we've come up with traditions in our family. It turns out for us, everybody getting together in this one place in North Carolina for Thanksgiving has been a constant. My daughter has never missed one her entire life, and she's now 22. So we have started to create certain kinds of traditions, and I should say we do a Christmas tree, we do a Passover Seder, we do our own version of the Passover Seder, which is both a combination where we read the text, the serious text, but then we're also rather irreverent, but that's part of our tradition. So to us, it's been important to have these kinds of traditions, but, you know, I don't know what my kids are going to do, and I guess I feel like, in a way, it's not important to me if the particular way we've kind of constructed our life gets preserved. If what turns out for them is a different structure and less tradition, more tradition, whatever, that's fine too. So I feel very humble about prescribing what the world needs, other than the fact that it needs a lot more general recognition of the humanity of everybody on this planet. That we need a lot of.
The book is Philosophers Without Gods, and it's a volume that includes 20 essays with titles like Life Without Gods, Some Personal Costs, An Atheist's Fundamentalism, An Aristotelian Life, Without the Net of Providence, Atheism and the Human Adventure, If God is Dead, Is Everything Permitted?, and Faith and Fanaticism. And Joseph Levine, my guest's article in the volume, is From Yeshiva Bahar to Secular Humanist. The volume is edited by Louise Antony. You can check it out. We've provided a link to it on againstthegrain.org, as well as a link to Joseph Levine's homepage at the University of Massachusetts Amherst, where he teaches philosophy. Thanks, Joe, so much for sharing your insights and joining us today.
Well, thank you very much. I enjoyed it a lot.
And this is CS suggesting the important thing is not to stop questioning, as Albert Einstein once said. And we will look for you next time. Against the Grain is co-produced by Sasha Lilly and C.S. Song. Please check us out on the web at againstthegrain.org, where you can find on-demand and downloadable audio. And it's the most reliable way I hear to sign up for our podcast. You can also call us at 510-848-6767, extension 670. And you can also check us out on Facebook at Against the Grain Radio. Many thanks to Erica Bridgman, who is at the controls today.